A preacher friend of mine was telling me a story one time about visiting another preacher, and he was so distraught over things going on with his work. They were sitting in his office, and he said, "I'm just sick." He said, "I can't eat, I can't sleep, I just can't relax because of all the things going on." And the preacher telling the story said, "I told him to sit down in his chair, and I opened up to the book of Psalms, and I started reading, and before too long, he was asleep." Now, I don't think it was because he found it so boring or soothing or anything like that, but more because of the words and the contents of it. A problem I often hear from people that I'm talking to, especially whenever they're dealing with anxiety, is they have difficulty sleeping. Now, I wanted to preface this lesson so that I can just talk about it and not have to worry. There are people who have trouble sleeping that they can't do anything about. I have a friend that he's an insomniac, and he has chemical issues with his brain that keep him from going to sleep, and he tries and is dealing with different things to help that. And there are also times we have trouble sleeping because of good things. And maybe you have a grandchild coming, or you have big things going on in your life that you're excited about. I'm not talking about any of those things, and I'm not saying that if you can't sleep, that it's sinful, okay? But, and this is something that only you can know, it can be a problem that you can deal with. And so what do we do in cases like that? Like with any issue that we have, we do what we can about it. And we're going to see what the greatest things that we can do to help our sleep are. And I want to start out just by looking at a couple of instances of people sleeping in very difficult situations, and I'm going to start in Acts chapter 12, verse 12, or Acts chapter 12, and the beginning of the chapter. We learn that Herod has just killed the first martyr that we read of whenever we're looking at the book of Acts. In verse 2, he killed James. And in verse 5, it says, "Peter was therefore kept in prison." Why? Because Herod saw how it pleased the people that he killed James. And that was what he intended to do to Peter. Now imagine if you had been imprisoned and the person who imprisoned you had just put to death someone that believed the same thing you did for doing basically the same thing. How would you feel about that? Well, in verse 5 it says, "Peter was therefore kept in prison, but constant prayer was offered to God for him by the church. And when Herod was about to bring him out, that night Peter was sleeping, bound with two chains between two soldiers, and the guards before the door were keeping the prison." Can you imagine being chained to chained and between two soldiers and sleeping? Why was Peter doing that? You could make the case and say he was probably just so exhausted. And can we get so exhausted that we just sleep at about any time? Okay, sure. But I would like to think, too, that Peter's faith had something to do with why he could sleep so well. And I want to turn back to Matthew 8. Matthew 8. Because in Matthew 8, we find the tables are turned just a little bit. And someone else is sleeping while others aren't. Others are pretty worried. When we come to Matthew 8, it says in verse 23, "Now when he got into a boat, his disciples followed him." And we're talking about Jesus here. The disciples followed Jesus. "And suddenly a great tempest arose over the sea, so that the boat was covered with waves, but he was asleep. Then his disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, 'Lord, save us. We are perishing.' But he said to them, 'Why are you fearful, O you of little faith?' Then he arose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. So the men marveled, saying, 'Who can this be that even the winds and sea obey him?'" I wanted to look at those and put them together because they'll serve as a good foundation to go to this psalm, the third psalm. Because who was on that boat with Jesus? His disciples. And these disciples weren't people unfamiliar with the sea. In fact, many of them were fishermen, right? This boat wasn't a boat of any great size. The Sea of Galilee was a sea a lake really, that was subject to very rapid storms. It wasn't something where someone would say, oh, I know the weather's going to be bad, but I'm going to go out it anyway. The way that the air would come down through the Mount Hermon chain, and you'd have cold air and warm air meeting, and that's always a bad chemistry for storms. And so it'd make the sea tumultuous. And for these men to be worried about it, evidently they probably were in danger in their minds, but what did they forget? On the boat, they had the master of wind and sea right there. Do you think that's why, maybe when Peter's life was so tumultuous in prison to Herod, and he had this great stormy trial of his faith, he could sleep because he had the master of the sea with him? He learned his lesson here, didn't he? Now, I want to go back to 1 Samuel chapter 15, because this is the background for Psalm 3, as it says there in the heading. And in 1 Samuel 15, we read of, I'm sorry, 2 Samuel 15, we read of perhaps one of the most heartbreaking kind of things that could happen to anyone. Because sure, you might lose a home, you might lose money, you might lose your health, but when it has something to do with your family, and especially betrayal by your family, how much harder does that make it? And this is what we're dealing with Absalom. Absalom was a child of David that he bore while he was reigning in Hebron within the first 7 years of his reign. You read about that in 1 Chronicles chapter 3, verses 1 through 4. In 1 Kings chapter 2, we find that David reigned for 40 years, 7 years in Hebron, 33 years in Jerusalem. Now, Absalom was born in sometime in that first 7 years. Keeping that in mind gives us a little bit of a timeline, because Absalom grows. We don't know what age he was when this happened, but let's read what's going on. Verse 1, after this it happened that Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. Now Absalom would rise early and stand beside the way to the gate. So it was whenever anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king for a decision that Absalom would call to him and say, "What city are you from?" And he would say, "Your servant is from such and such a tribe of Israel." Then Absalom would say to him, "Look, your case is good and right, but there is no deputy of the king to hear you." Moreover, Absalom would say, "Oh, that I were made a judge in the land, and everyone who has any suit or case would come to me. Then I would give him justice." And so it was, whenever anyone came near to bow down to him, that he would put out his hand and take him and kiss him. What was Absalom doing? This is known today as politicking. Absalom was engaging in politics. He was waiting out in the gate of the city. This is a place where the wise men came, where disputes came, and he was also cutting off access to his father. So people would see Absalom, and Absalom would hear them out, and he would give them pity. And he'd say, "Oh, I wish somebody would hear you, but there's nobody. There's nobody to hear you, and if I had power, I would hear you." And people began to love him. As you continue to read in verse 6, it says, "In this manner Absalom acted toward all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel." Now it came to pass after, now this is a little discrepancy. If you have an ESV, NIV, it probably says 4 years. New King James, King James, ASV, others will say 40. Hebrew numbers are tricky. And so this isn't anything to be overly concerned about, but we know Absalom didn't do this for 40 years. Because if, say, he was 18 when he did this, when he started, and he was 40 when it finished, then his father's been now reigning for over 50 years. And that doesn't work. But since the word could also be four, it could be understood as four, and that's the way it is in some texts, it seems like Absalom has done this plan for 4 years. And so he's had this plot to subvert the throne, to take it away from his father. And what's he doing? He's getting a gathering of people to really support him in this by giving them sympathy, showing his pity. And he's been doing it for years. And he says to his father, "Please let me go to Hebron and pay the vow which I made to the Lord. For your servant took a vow while I dwelt in Geshur in Syria, saying, if the Lord indeed brings me back to Jerusalem, then I will serve the Lord. And the king said to him, go in peace. So he rose and went to Hebron. Now he's leaving to the old reigning place of David, sort of another place of rule to accomplish his plan. He makes this excuse to his father that he's going to go and make a vow, fulfill a vow to God. And then he does this in verse 10. Then Absalom sent spies throughout all the tribes of Israel, saying, as soon as you hear the sound of the trumpet, you shall say, Absalom reigns in Hebron. And with Absalom went 200 men invited from Jerusalem, and they went along innocently and did not know anything. Then Absalom sent for Ahithophel the Gilonite, David's counselor from his city, from Gilal, while he offered sacrifices, and the conspiracy grew strong, for the people with Absalom continually increased in number. Absalom's been working on this, and the conspiracy is growing greatly. Now a messenger came to David saying, the hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom. Imagine how David would feel after years. His son just lied to him and left, and then he gets a messenger who comes back and breaks this news to him that there's been this conspiracy to take the throne, and that Absalom has actually managed to get the hearts of the people behind him. How many years of lying? How many years of deceit from this family member? And we don't have a home that's up for grabs. We don't have someone, just a bank account. What we have is an entire kingdom that's about to be taken from the hands of David. And it says in verse 14, so David said to all his servants who were with him at Jerusalem, arise and let us flee, or we shall not escape from Absalom. Make haste to depart, lest he overtake us suddenly and bring disaster upon us and strike the city with the edge of the sword. What David knows as he puts the pieces together is that over the years, Absalom's created a following over all of Israel. You have to remember that we're in the reign of David. All 12 tribes are united, and they've been coming to Jerusalem, and they've been heard by Absalom, and they think he's the one to make judge and ruler, to really make things work out. And he's put messengers throughout the kingdom to say that Absalom reigns. And then it says in verse 15, and the king's servant said to the king, we are your servants, ready to do whatever my lord the king commands. In a matter of moments, David has gone from the being a king of one of the powers of the world to fleeing from his own castle, his own palace. And it says in verse 16, then the king went out with all his household after him, but the king left 10 women, concubines, to keep the house, and the king went out with all the people after him and stopped at the outskirts. Then all his servants passed before him, and the Cherethites, all the Pelethites, and all the Gittites, 600 men who had followed him from Gath, passed before the king. Then the king said to Ittai, the Gittite, why are you also going with us? Return to remain with the king, for you are a foreigner and also an exile from your own place. In fact, you came only yesterday. Should I make you wander up and down with us today, since I go, I know not where? Did you catch that? He doesn't know where he's going. He doesn't know what he's going to do. How do you feel when you don't have a plan? You just heard terrible news and you don't know how to handle it. He's lost everything. He doesn't know what he's going to do. Verse 21, but Ittai answered the king and said, as the Lord lives and as my lord the king lives, surely in whatever place my lord the king shall be, whether in death or life, even there also your servant will be. So David said to Ittai, go and cross over. And then Ittai the Gittite and all his men and all the little ones who were with him crossed over. Look at this in verse 23. Because what we're talking about here is a land that God promised to his people that have been, that's been in the recorded history of the Bible from earlier than just about anything. And look at what it says. It says, and all the country wept with a loud voice, and all the people crossed over. The king himself also crossed over the brook Kidron, and all the people crossed over toward the wilderness. There was Zadok also, and all the Levites with him, bearing the Ark of the Covenant of God, and they sat down the Ark of God. And Abiathar went up until all the people had finished crossing over the city. Verse 25. Then the king said to Zadok, "Carry the ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the eyes of the Lord, he will bring me back and show me both it and his dwelling place. But if he says, 'Thus I have no delight in you,' here I am. Let him do to me as seems good to him." The king also said to Zadok the priest, "Are you not a seer? Return to the city in peace, and your two sons with you, Ahimaaz, and your son, and Jonathan the son of Abiathar. See, I will wait in the plains of the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me." Therefore, Zadok and Abiathar carried the ark of God back to Jerusalem, and they remained there. Verse 30. So David went up by the ascent of the Mount of Olives and wept as he went up. And he had his head covered and went barefoot, and all the people who were with him covered their heads and went up weeping as they went up. This is the background to Psalm 3. Now, how is it that David could say in verse 5 of Psalm 3, "I lay down and slept"? We've all received news that's caused us to lie awake at night, wondering what is it we're going to do. I can't believe that this could happen. I can't believe that they could do that. Couldn't all of those things have rolled through David's mind? It says, "I laid down and slept." Well, we see the keys here in the psalm. First of all, we can't doubt that he was troubled. And I would challenge you to talk about having more trouble than David. Are you surprised that some of these examples are given to us in Scripture? Have any of us ever been pursued by an army led by a king who happened to be our son, who had tried to steal the kingdom from us? That makes any of my problems look tiny. David went from a king to being homeless in one day. And it's his son doing it. So he says in verses 1 and 2, "Lord, how they have increased who trouble me." And talk about it. They increased overnight. They were really increasing over the years, but he didn't know all the trouble until it came out all at once. "Many are those who rise up against me. Many are those who say to me, 'There is no help for him in God.'" Selah. Now think about that. They thought that he didn't have any help. And they thought that David was a minority, and therefore he wouldn't be able to make it through this attempt to take over the throne. Now, keep on looking, though, and we see the first key is David trusted in God. They said, "It's hopeless, and he doesn't have help." David knew that God was his help. In verse 3, he says, "But you, O Lord, are a shield for me, my glory and the one who lifts up my head." The reason David could sleep, number one, is that he trusted in God. Whenever you go to Psalm 62, there's a beautiful picture there. And it echoes this all through the Psalms. This is brought up, but this is one of my favorites. And David writes, "Truly my soul silently waits for God. From him comes my salvation. He only is my rock and my salvation. He is my defense. I shall not be greatly moved." That's the point. Since God only was David's salvation, it wasn't his kingdom that he relied on to make him feel safe. It wasn't his bank account. It wasn't even his palace guard. Even though he had all these valiant men, and he had these 600 that went with him at this time, he was outnumbered. Whenever you consider that at times the army of Israel was numbered at over 600,000 men. And so if he depended on his kingdom, if he depended on his money, if he depended on his army, then he would have no comfort. But since God was really solely the source of his comfort, and he could trust in him, then David could have peace. And not only did he trust in God, but he also went to God. Does it do any good to trust in someone or something and then not use it? Whenever you look at someone traveling, they might be like me, and if you read the fine print in a hotel's paperwork, what you learn is many of the hotels, and I'm looking at some of you guys because I know you want to know this, many of the hotels charge you for the safe that's in the room. They charge you for it already. But if you don't use the safe, they won't charge you, but they'll charge you anyway, regardless if you use it or not, unless you say, take the money for the safe off of my bill, and then they'll take it off. Okay, so tell them to take the money off of your bill, and then you sit your wallet and things out of the safe, and then you leave and someone breaks in your room and steals your things. The safe didn't do you any good, did it? Now, what if you paid for it, but you didn't put your wallet in the safe? It didn't do you any good, did it? Because you didn't use what you had in order to have safety and protection. Well, what good would it do for David to say, oh, I know God's there, but I'm not going to go to him and put my trust in him. He put his trust in him, and he went to him. Verse 4, I cried to the Lord with my voice, and he heard me from his holy hill. But look at how all these things have to go together. Because when you look at God being trustworthy, it's because David had gone to him over and over. Whenever you look at verse 7, he says in the second half of that verse, for you have struck all my enemies on the cheekbone. You have broken the teeth of the ungodly. What did David know? David knew that when Saul was chasing him, that when Saul had his army against him, and the Philistines were on the other side fighting against him, that every time God delivered him. So he could relax and trust in God because he'd already gone to God over and over and over again. And so not only did he trust in him, but he went to him, and it was his habit to go to him. And guess what? God never let him down. And he gives us that promise too. Whenever we read in the letter to the Romans, in chapter 8, we find that they were undergoing persecution from the Jews and even some Jewish Christians who had departed from the faith. And Paul is reminding them that it's all going to be okay. And he gives them this reasoning, even stronger than what David gave. You've protected me over and over again, and so I know I'm going to be okay. I can sleep. Verse 31, he says, what then shall we say to these things? If God is for us, who can be against us? Now, what establishes that God is for us? Verse 32, he who did not spare his own son, but delivered him up for us all, how shall he not with him also freely give us all things? How can we lie awake at night worrying about the things that Jesus talked about in Matthew chapter 6, our food, our clothing, our shelter, when God gave us his son? And what did Jesus say? He said, you seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. Do we not think, he's making the argument here from the bigger to the smaller, do we not think that if God gave us the biggest thing he could possibly give us, the life of his perfect son, that he's not going to take care of these little things? Now, that doesn't mean that everything's going to work out the way we want it to. That's the difficulty in trusting, like what James was talking about in James 4. We need to learn to say, if the Lord wills, I'll do this or that. We need to learn about the prayer that Jesus gave in the garden, that not my will, but yours be done. But knowing that, we trust in a God who over and over has cared for his people in ways beyond what any of them could imagine. Putting our trust in him, going to him regularly, there's a history of it. It creates a habit. Look at great men of faith and what did they do? Daniel had a habit of going and praying three times a day, didn't he? It was his custom to do it. These men regularly went to God. Hezekiah, when he heard that he was going to die, he put his problems before God, saying that. Whenever he was threatened by the army, he wrote it out. He put the letter out in front of God to take care of it. And we're told in 1 Peter chapter 5 to cast our burdens on him. We need to be casting our burdens on him, for he cares for us. It's a habit that we make in going to him in prayer. And that was one reason that David could lay down and sleep. And finally, and this is really what happened first, but all these things worked because David was God's man. He was on God's side. Because he says in verse 6, I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves up all against me all around. Now that's foolishness if you're going at them on your own without God. That's just insane thinking. I'm not going to be afraid of 10,000s of men. That's something that you can be institutionalized for. But what makes it all work? He says in verse 7, "Arise, O Lord, save me, O my God, for you have struck all my enemies on your cheekbone. You have broken the teeth of the ungodly." You have a history of this. Why? Verse 8, "Salvation belongs to the Lord. Your blessing is upon your people." Salah. This promise isn't something given just to everybody who decides, "I'm going to act like I'm bulletproof and you can't hurt me." This promise is given to people who truly put their trust in God and can be called God's people. And we just talked about that on the orange card today. This isn't a kid's thing. We have our young people come up front because it's a fantastic thing for them to learn and a great way for us to work on this together and support them. But what we're learning there is how someone becomes a person of God. Whenever we look at the church, God's kingdom, we see that the Lord added to the church daily those who are being saved. That's not Van making it up. It's not just a wish or a guess in your head. What it is we look at Scripture and we find that God revealed in His Scripture how we become one of His people. One of those people for whom He gave His only Son, and if He gave His Son for us, how shall He not freely give us all things? And so when we become one of His people, we can look back at men like David and we can say, "I'm one of His. And since I'm one of His, I can make a habit of regularly going to Him." James says the fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much, not the fervent prayer of anyone desperately reaching, though they aren't deciding to live faithful for God. He says the fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. Why? Because we approach God through faith by the way given to us through Jesus Christ that we read about in Hebrews chapter 10. And we can know that by faith because we've been assured of it in the Scriptures over and over and over again. And the peace of mind that that can give us, that the Creator of the universe is working on our problems when we pray to Him, is something that can help us get to sleep, especially when it's something that's a habit of ours because we trust in Him and we have over and over. Now, we talked about that, but there was a time when God's own Son didn't sleep. Whenever we go into Luke chapter 22, verse 39, we see a group of people who are trying to take Jesus' kingdom from Him. Now, they don't understand it because it's a spiritual kingdom and it can't be taken physically. But He flees this city that's about to take Him back in and unjustly try Him and kill Him on the cross. And look at where He was in verse 39. In the footsteps of David, who was 1,000 years before Him, it says, "Coming out, He went to the Mount of Olives, as He was accustomed, and His disciples followed Him. Then when He came to a place, He said to them, 'Pray that you may not enter into temptation.'" We learn that this is the Garden of Gethsemane. Gethsemane means olive press. So He's on the Mount of Olives. And it says in verse 41, "And He was withdrawn from them about a stone's throw, and He knelt down and prayed, saying, 'Father, if it is your will, take this cup away from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done.'" When we look at Matthew, we learn that He's done this. He's going to do this 3 times. And He comes back once, and the disciples are asleep. And He comes back again, and the disciples are asleep. Now, who's not asleep? Jesus. Who is asleep? The disciples. Isn't that interesting? And here, whenever we look in verse 43, it says, "Then an angel appeared to Him from heaven, strengthening Him, and being in agony, He prayed more earnestly. Then His sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. When He rose up from prayer, He had come to His disciples. He found them sleeping from sorrow." The disciples were sorrowful, but they weren't really sure of what and what kind of sorrow, to what extent they should have. They just knew that Jesus was greatly distressed. And Peter, James, and John came out with Him. And the only reason I know that the disciples were asleep for sorrow is because Luke says it. But here's something interesting. Jesus didn't sleep, and He knew what was coming. David, running from Jerusalem, on the Mount of Olives did sleep because he knew God would take care of him. Jesus on the Mount of Olives being run out of what was really his proper place, in a way of speaking, he didn't sleep because he knew the gravity of what was coming. And he went to the cross having not slept so that we, looking back to the cross, can sleep. Think about that. He really took all the problems of the world on himself when he went through that trial and was put on the cross that next day, so that we don't have to have all the problems of the world on our shoulders when we lay down and try to sleep. He didn't, so we can. Now, do you think if the disciples knew the extent of what was going to happen that night, that right now Judas is getting a group of troops together to get Jesus and to take and crucify him, do you think they would have been able to sleep? This is Van's guess, but I would say they wouldn't have, because they would have understood the greatness of the situation that was approaching. And I want to ask you a question. Now, there are a lot of houses here that heat with fire, with wood heat. And I have a carbon monoxide detector on the top stair of my basement, because my understanding is it rises. And so by the time I get to the top stair, this is my simple thinking, if that thing's going off, I've got some time to do things. What do I need to do? I need to go and I need to open windows. I need to get everybody out of the house, and I need to figure out what's causing the carbon monoxide issue. Would you ever lay down in bed and hear beep, 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 and say, "Oh, that's the carbon monoxide detector," and go to sleep? You wouldn't do it. Why? Because you know what's at stake. You are not about to go to sleep with the carbon monoxide detector going off. And that's what I would urge you tonight. Because yes, you have medical reasons for not being able to sleep. You have perfectly fine reasons for not being able to sleep. But sometimes you can't sleep because it's not safe for you to sleep. Sometimes you can't get your mind to relax because the softest pillow is a good conscience and you don't have it. And it needles at you and it keeps you awake and you have nightmares about what it is that you need to change. I would urge you not to sleep. If I had my wish, it would be that no one would get rest in their eyes until they've come to Christ for the forgiveness of their sins, until, if it's someone who has come to him, until they come back if they've departed from him. Maybe that's a problem, a reason that you're having trouble sleeping. Maybe you know the things that you need to do. Don't go any longer without dealing with it. Whenever we look at Proverbs 6, the Proverbs writer is actually just writing about getting in debt foolishly, but he says, "Don't give sleep to your eyes. You fight it like an animal in a trap," is what he says. And that's the same thing we need to do tonight. If there's a sin in your life, if there's something holding you back from sleeping because there's something you need to do about it, don't fall asleep with the alarm going off. God put that in us to help motivate us to do the right thing. If you're living for Him, cast your cares and burdens on Him. He cares for you. And know that Jesus carried the weight of the world on His shoulders so you wouldn't have to, so that you could trust in Him. Go to Him and know over and over He will deliver you. But whatever your need is, let us know by having a seat up front as we stand and sing the invitation song.